My name is Pat Hayden, and I come to the subject of Namibia with passionate concern and some very personal involvement. For 5 years, from the middle of 1977 until February of this year, I worked in the Lutheran World Ministries Office of Scholarship and Exchange in New York City. This LWM is a Lutheran cooperative agency representing activities of the ALC, LCA, and AELC. My involvement in that international scholarship and exchange program was largely with Namibian and South African students. So a lot of my own knowledge of this situation has grown during those 5 years of contact and conversation with these men and women. So that's the point at which I begin. I am not objective about this subject at all, as you will see as we go ahead. And what I'm going to present to you this morning is a little bit of the political and economic, political history of Namibia, a little bit of the current economic conditions, some information about the work of the Lutheran churches in Namibia, and finally, some very important information about what U.S. Lutherans are doing and what you and I can do to join in this effort. I have a map, which I hope some of you can see, of the continent of Africa. The country of Namibia is in southern Africa, along the Atlantic coast, on the western side of the continent, down almost at the very bottom. In many maps, older maps, it's called Southwest Africa, which is its colonial name. Namibia is its liberation name and gets its name from one of the three major features of the country, which is the Namib Desert. The Namib Desert runs along the coast of Namibia. It's a very forbidding and awesome sight, this 40 to 80 miles of desert sand dunes, which runs right next to the water's edge. But the only rain that the desert gets is fog that comes from the ocean. Many years ago, there was a National Geographic television special on the Namib Desert. If they redo it and you have a chance to see it, please do. It's a most fascinating piece of ecological history. In the middle of Namibia is a central plateau with mountains and plains. And on the eastern and northern edge of Namibia is another desert, the Kalahari Desert, which also is a very dry and barren area that is shared with the country of Botswana, who is one of Namibia's neighbors. So it's a very easily understood fact why we are trying to raise money for well drilling projects in Namibia. It's a very dry country, and water is far below the surface of the ground in water tables, and wells are needed in order to bring up water for crops, for cattle, for people, to supplement the rainfall, which is minimal at best, and during the last period of several years has been interrupted by two very severe droughts, which have lasted anywhere from 3 to 5 years in duration, with only 1 or 2 years in between them in which there was normal rainfall. One of the other major features of Namibia is the Etosha Pan, which is is in the central highlands area, becomes a lake during the rainy season, and is the site of a good deal of very magnificent wildlife in the African setting. National Geographic also did a special about this, so if you have a chance to see it, do. The population in this country, which is about twice the size of California, or if you compress it all together, about the area of the state of Montana, is 1.5 million people, although there's no real recent census. 80% of the country's population is black. 10% is what the South Africans called mixed race, which is black and white. And 10% is white. Most of the black Namibians are tribes, traditional African tribes. The largest one is called the Ovambos, O-V-A-M-A-B-O-S. And their site is in the northern part of Namibia and the southern part of Angola. When the European nations arbitrarily drew the boundaries of Africa, they went right through the tribal lands of the Ovambo people. So half of them are now considered Angolans and half of them are Namibians. Many of the other tribes' people are the Kavangos, who exist along also the northern border in this little strip that goes over into Zambia and Botswana. The Herero tribe, the Namas, the Daras, there are many different tribes in Namibia. The whites are mostly German in ancestry and South African, which means they come of Dutch and English stock. Why is the country of Namibia important? How many of you know something about Namibia before I start this? Have you heard of Namibia? Can she see a show of hands? Okay.
Only what I read, natural resources.
Okay. Some of you have heard a little bit about. Those of you who have, please bear with me if I repeat stuff you already know. Those of you who have not, I hope this will help you with some basic information. Namibia is important for four reasons, I think. The first one is it is the only remaining non-independent country in Africa. The second reason is it is a colony of the Republic of South Africa, which has resisted and opposed all attempts to have Namibia become an independent, self-governing country. The story of Namibia is a political story, as we will hear. It's an economic story, and it is a religious story. While this is one story, I will try to separate it into these three parts for a little bit more clarity. And finally, it is a critical story for us as U.S. citizens at this time in our history and into the future. When I say that it is the only remaining non-independent country in Africa, you should know that during the 19th century, this whole continent was colonized by European nations. England, Portugal, Germany, France all came into Africa and carved it up into their own territories, which they ruled and governed, the Dutch as well. And during the 20th century, one of the major processes of history has been that this continent has become independent of this colonial rule. The first country to become independent was Ghana in 1960. The most recent country to become independent was Zimbabwe, or former Rhodesia, in 1980. So within the last 25 years, there has been this explosive growth of independence and self-government of peoples in Africa. Namibia began as a German colony in the middle 1880s, and was ruled by them for 30 years until the First World War. During the First World War, South Africa invaded Namibia in 1915. They have occupied it, and they have remained there since that date. So this struggle goes back a long, long time. In 1918 and 19, when the First World War concluded with the Peace of Versailles and the creation of the League of Nations, South Africa was given a mandate to assist the development of Namibia as a sacred trust under the League of Nations. It was required to report every year to the League of Nations on its administration of this mandate. It did so until 1939, when the Second World War broke out and the League of Nations dissolved. There were no further reports until 1945, until the creation of the United Nations. And with the creation of the United Nations came the beginning of a conflict which continues to this day. That is, that the United Nations says that it is the legal heir of the League of Nations and should therefore assume the responsibility of Namibia as a trust under the trusteeship council of the United Nations. South Africa has consistently maintained that the United Nations has no jurisdiction over former League mandates, and so it has refused to accept UN direction in this matter. And this battle between the United Nations and South Africa, which began in 1945, continued until 1966. So it's important, I think, to have a sense of history of how long this struggle has been going on and in what kinds of forms. The conflict has been between two different points of view about this country, Namibia. The first one is the point of view of the United Nations Charter, which says that the country ought to be administered toward self-government and independence, that there should be respect for human rights, and no distinction made on the basis of color or sex, language or religion, and that there should be equal treatment in social, economic, and commercial matters. The viewpoint of South Africa, on the other hand, is that Namibia is to be governed by the laws of its own republic, which are the laws of apartheid. Not only the separation of the races, white from black, but also the enslavement of the black race to serve the economic interests of the white race. And secondly, that Namibia should be annexed to South Africa and become a part, an extension of its own republic. During the 21 years between 1945 and 1966, there was a continuing dialogue between South Africa and the United Nations, which the United Nations tried special committees, persuasions, negotiations. They attempted to visit Namibia and in three or four cases were rebuffed by the South Africans, who refused to let them into the country to see the conditions of the people. And they undertook legal actions through primarily the International Court of to carry an identification book, the setting up of reserved separate sections of the country in which blacks may live and whites may live, and a policing of the movement from blacks to white areas and whites to black areas. This activity continued and is described in this little book, which is in the Holden Library. It's called A Trust Betrayed, Namibia. It's a UN publication. And if you want to just read about the consistent, steady, persuasive efforts of the United Nations between 1945 and 1973 to get South Africa to acknowledge the need for Namibia to become an independent nation, this is a good book to read. The turning point came in 1966, when the International Court of Justice, after 6 years of deliberation, ruled on a petition by two members of the League of Nations, formerly Ethiopia and Liberia, who asked the Court of Justice to make South Africa give over to these two countries, as also members of the League of Nations, the administration of this territory. The International Court of Justice ruled in 1966 by a vote of 8-7 that Ethiopia and Liberia had no grounds for their case, and that South Africa was not accountable to them as member states of the League of Nations. This was a devastating blow for the United Nations and for the people of Namibia, and it caused great rejoicing in the Republic of South Africa. What happened the very next October of that same year, 1966, was that the United Nations, by action of its General Assembly, terminated the League of Nations mandate to South Africa for the country of Namibia and declared Namibia to be the direct responsibility of the United Nations. In 1967, they set up a special committee to oversee problems and issues related to Namibia. South Africa, of course, refused to recognize that action by the General Assembly. And the United Nations, in response, brought another case to the International Court of Justice, asking the court to decide whether or not the UN had acted legally in 1966, and if South Africa was therefore illegally in Namibia. If the UN had acted legally to terminate South Africa's mandate in Namibia, then South Africa was illegally in the country of Namibia. The International Court of Justice took 5 years to deliberate this case, and in 1971, by a vote of 13-2, they upheld the United Nations that it had acted legally in terminating the League of Nations mandate to South Africa, and saying further that South Africa was illegally occupying Namibia. That's very important to remember. That's now 12 years ago that the International Court of Justice made that decision. Of course, South Africa refused to acknowledge and accept that decision. In 1974, the National Liberation Movement of Namibia, which is called SWAPO, S-W-A-P-O, and stands for the Southwest Africa People's Organization, was recognized as the sole legitimate, authentic liberation movement and voice for Namibia. SWAPO had begun early in the 1950s as a part of the effort of citizens inside Namibia. I use that word citizens in quotes because blacks have no voice or vote or right to own property in Namibia until much later. To organize to protest South African action in their country and to try to take steps to end their rule. In the middle 1960s, with the International Court of Justice opinion in favor of South Africa, the liberation movement stepped up its activities on behalf of independence. And in 1966, the activities moved from a diplomatic and peaceful persuasion effort inside Namibia to guerrilla efforts, to military struggle. And the military arm of SWAPO exists alongside the diplomatic and political arm of SWAPO, and they have continued to work as one organization with two different components since that time in attempting to bring independence to their country. SWAPO is consistently referred to in the U.S. press as terrorists and Marxist guerrillas. And we'll have something to say more about that a little bit later. In 1978, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 435, in which they called for a ceasefire in Namibia, a cessation of the military conflict between South African Defense Forces and SWAPO guerrilla groups, free and fair elections to be supervised by the United Nations, the withdrawal of South African troops from Namibia back into South Africa to be replaced by an international peacekeeping force made up of United Nations troops, and the release of all political prisoners. This resolution is the one that is still trying to be implemented in Namibia today. South Africa, since 1978, has imposed one condition after another that must be met before it will accept Resolution 435. There are many of them, and I will just tell you a couple of them. One is the question of the impartiality of the United Nations to supervise free and fair elections, and the request of South Africa that a constitutional convention for the country of Namibia be drawn up prior to free and fair elections. These have been consistently negotiated by both the United Nations and SWAPO acting on behalf of the Namibian people. But Resolution 435 still remains to be implemented in Namibia. In 1978, as a result of growing frustration in the United Nations, when African nations were talking about imposing political and economic sanctions against South Africa for their consistent refusal to budge on Namibia, there was formed what is known as the Western Contact Group, five nations, the United States, Canada, Great Britain, France, and Germany, who, because they did not want their own economic interests and political interests to be affected by the possibility of UN sanctions, agreed to try to persuade South Africa to implement, to agree to the implementation of Resolution 435. This group has been at work since 1978, many conversations back and forth in South Africa, in various parts of Europe, many conferences in which Namibians have come, as well as the Western Contact Group. There was much more activity and positive hope between 78 and 80 for the Western Contact Group than there has been since 1980. And the major factor in the change was the election of Ronald Reagan to the presidency of the United States. With the election of Mr. Reagan, the policy of the U.S. toward South Africa changed from one of non-support and pressure to get them to implement the UN resolution to one of cooperation and support, what the president calls a policy of constructive engagement with South Africa. For the first time in many, many years under the Reagan administration, military advisors from South Africa have been allowed in the United States to meet with members of the U.S. Defense Department. There have been various kinds of political and diplomatic exchanges during the last 3 years, and an increased amount of support for U.S. businesses doing support in South Africa. There has not been any direct military and economic aid to South Africa because this is not permitted by the U.S. Congress. But there has been all kinds of indirect aid to South Africa through friendly allies with the United States, specifically Israel. And there are sources which document this if any of you are interested in following it up. Since 1982, the United States has imposed an additional condition on the implementation of Resolution 435, and that is that Cuban troops who are present in the neighboring country of Angola must withdraw before a ceasefire and free and fair elections can take place in Namibia. This condition came literally for this whole process of negotiations out of the blue and was a condition imposed by the Reagan administration because of its east-west policies of conflict with the Soviet Union. I will answer more questions about that later if you would like, but I'd like to go on and just leave that it is a condition of the U.S. government. It's a condition which South Africa has accepted. It's a condition which the United Nations and SWAPO reject, as well as the church leaders in Namibia, as we will hear a little bit later. So that brings us up pretty much to the present time. The stalemate continues between the United Nations and South Africa. An attempt by the South Africans in 1978 to set up a puppet government inside Namibia which would have a multiracial character. This puppet government was called the Democratic Turnhalle Alliance. It collapsed under internal friction and discord in 1982. Are there any questions about the political configuration of all this before we go on?
Why is this country so important to east or west? What is there beside the desert?
What is there beside the desert? That's a wonderful question. Thank you for answering it, because it's exactly what I'm going to talk about next. Why is this country worth all of this conflict and struggle and increasingly death and destruction and dehumanization of people? It is because Namibia perhaps is the wealthiest country in Africa, except for South Africa itself. Economists have said that if all of the mineral wealth of Namibia were divided among the 1.5 million people in that country, individual Namibians would be the wealthiest people in the whole continent of Africa. Their primary resources are uranium, diamonds, gold, oil, and increasingly fishery resources and what we call in this country Persian lamb, which over there is called Karalkal. It's a special kind of sheep. But you can see how many of those are either strategic materials or luxury goods. Namibia is very wealthy in all of these. I forgot one, copper. They also have a very large percentage of the world's copper resources in Namibia. All of these resources are owned and produced, many would say exploited, by foreign companies. None of them are owned and controlled by black Namibians. South Africans control the diamonds. An American conglomerate controls the copper. A British conglomerate controls much of the uranium. Gulf Oil and one other oil company, which I can't remember right now, control the oil. Purina is involved in the sardine fishery industry. There are many U.S., English, German economic interests in Namibia. That's the reason it's so important. How do these economic interests work? You've heard enough, perhaps, about the third world to know that it is at the exploitation of very cheap labor. Namibia works on a contract system. Black workers are hired by these companies for 9 to 12 months. They leave their families and go as laborers to work in the mines and the fishery industries. They may not take their families with them, and they are allowed to return for at most 1 month a year. They live 600 men together in a barracks, and they have no educational, cultural activity at all. They are simply there to work every day. In 1983, in April of this year, Dr. Abisai Shayavali, who is the executive secretary of the Council of Churches in Namibia, made a statement before the Human Rights Commission on conditions in Namibia. And these are some of the things that he said. Wages for those who work in the mines vary from 54 cents an hour to $1.79 an hour. In the uranium mines especially, there is no protection for the workers. There are no safety measures. There are no medical exams or checks. The tailings of the uranium mines are simply dumped next to where the miners are living and working, and they are exposed to all that radioactivity with no protection at all. In the field of education, South Africa provides Bantu education for black Namibians, as it does for black South Africans. Blacks must pay to go to school. Whites do not have to pay. Namibia in the, South Africa spends in Namibia $207 for each black student, $1,600 for each white student. 84% of the white students are in school, 14% of black students in Namibia are in school. In 1982, there were 1,376 high school graduates in the whole nation of Namibia. Of those 1,376, 376 were black. The rest were white.
Only 20 that year entered university. In the health field, $211 are spent on white medical care, $34 are spent on black medical care. I would like to read one thing about the law, which really is a joke in Namibia. Cheap prison labor is provided to farmers and prisoners. Instead of having the protection of the state, they are exposed to sadistic, racist acts by white farmers. This is Dr. Sayavali's testimony. Recently, one young prisoner was slowly tortured to death over 3 days by one such farmer. The farmer was sentenced to 6 months in jail, whereas Ida Jimmy, a black woman, was jailed for 7 years because she stated at a public meeting that she would give food to a gorilla who happened to be her blood brother. A law prohibiting public gatherings prevents any group of more than 20 people to get together without the permission of a magistrate. SWAPO has been banned for many years in Namibia and may not operate legally. In addition to this, there is a military campaign going on, a war inside the country. There have been estimates ranging from 300,000 to 500,000 South African troops that are fighting primarily in the northern part of the country. They are also supported by a special section of the South African army called COVID, or One Way, which is literally a death squad, a reign of terror squad for the Namibians. This detachment is made up of mercenaries from Angola, South Africa, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe, and from Western countries. They come into the villages disguised as SWAPO soldiers. They kill, wound people, commit robberies, and commit wanton shootings. Some of the young blacks are recruited to serve in this one-way terror force and are given money and guns and alcohol to commit terror against their own families throughout the country. One other thing about education, if I can back up a minute, in relation to the military efforts, Dr. Sayavali told the Human Rights Commission that in many of the Bantu schools, the teachers are South African white soldiers who teach wearing their military uniforms and carrying their guns. The psychological effect that this has on the students in terms of fear and confusion as to the purposes of education is not too hard to imagine. Where is the church in all this? Most of the people of Namibia are Christians. Most of the people in Namibia are Lutheran Christians, the vast majority of them. In the middle 1800s, the Finns came to the Obombo Kavango area and began missionary work there. The Germans came to the middle part of the country near the capital city of Windhoek and began missionary work there. These two churches, the Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo Kavango Church in the north, for which the money is being raised for water projects, and the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Southwest Africa, Namibia, around the Windhoek area, are the two major Lutheran churches in Namibia. Other churches include Anglican, Roman Catholic, Methodist, and African Methodist Episcopal. Together, all of these churches form the Council of Churches in Namibia, which is related not only to the South African Council of Churches, but also to the World Council of Churches. According to Paul Wee, who is the executive director of Lutheran World Ministries, 100% of the Ivambos and 50% of all Namibians are Lutheran. The largest Lutheran church is the one in the north, where the vast majority of the people live. I could tell you many stories from my own work with ELOC students who have come about their experiences of terror and repression at the hands of the South African government. But I would like to just tell you one, because we don't have a lot of time, to try to focus the work of the church. The church has been steadily and courageously an opponent and an outspoken opponent against South African activities in Namibia, both internally in Namibia to South Africa and on the international scene. ELOC, as we call it, Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo Kavango Church, has a press, and this press prints all the school books that are used in the Lutheran High School in the north. It prints all the greeting cards that are exchanged at Christmas. It prints all the bulletins and other material songbooks and liturgies that are used in services throughout the north. It also prints a church newspaper. This press has been blown up twice in the last 10 years. The most recent time was in November of 1981, just before Christmas and just before school was to begin, with when all of the books for the school were being run. One speculation of the reason why it was blown up was that in the spring of 1981, the newspaper published a list of names that had been found on the body of a South African soldier that had been a South African soldier who had been wounded in a mine attack. This list was found, and so the paper published it. It had 25 names on it, and they were the names of all the prominent religious and business leaders in the northern part of Namibia. The bishop's name of the ELOC church was on it, as were several others. The first five names of the list were crossed off. All of those people had met their death in the preceding few months by some kind of violent means. So it was a hit list. It's not the only one that's been found, but it was one that the church was able to publish in the newspaper. And when we ask why they would run the risk of publishing this list in the newspaper, Bishop Demeny looked at me and smiled, and he said, "None of the rest of us have died. It's the best life insurance that we have." But they blew up the press. It took the South African Defense Force 8 hours after the initial call from the church to get to the scene of when the press was blown up. It was blown up at midnight. You should know that there is a dusk to dawn curfew in the northern part of Namibia. If you are out 1/2 hour after the curfew goes into effect, when the sun has gone down, you are shot on sight. No questions asked, just simply shot. And so people don't move. If a woman goes into labor at dusk, she and her husband and children must simply wait until dawn comes before they can even go to their neighbor to get help. It is that kind of situation. Barbed wire exists around most of the small communities where the church people live, and these areas are patrolled by tanks and other armored vehicles. The men and women of the church who engage in youth work and women's activities, who go into the parishes to conduct services as they do every Sunday, must travel over roads which are mined both by the South Africans and by SWAPO. And the church has lost many pastors and youth workers to these mines. We have one person studying in the United States as a youth worker. I mean, he's studying here, he was a youth worker there, who survived three such mine blasts as he went about his regular work for the church. If you want to hear something about the strength and the vitality and the piety of these people, I would encourage you to listen to a tape that Holden has in its library. Dr. Paul Wee went to Namibia in 1979 in June for the consecration of Bishop Dumeni, and he talks about the experience of that consecration and the services that he was able to attend in the northern part of Namibia. The church continues to see its activity in relation to its own people, in relation to all those who have left as refugees and gone across the border into Angola and Zambia. Pastors sometimes have gone with them in the refugee camps. Every Sunday they hold services. There are services during all the liturgical seasons of the year, during Advent and Lent. Baptisms, confirmation classes go on regularly, despite all of this war effort around them. It really is just astonishing, but it's true. This ministry in the midst of war, the hospital, the Seoul Lutheran Hospital up here, has had one of its doctors placed under house arrest, which means he can't leave his compound, and that the two other doctors, two of the other three doctors, were Finnish doctors who had their permits to be in Namibia revoked by the South African government about 3 years ago, have not been allowed back into the country. So the hospital is served by one physician and several nurses. When I had the privilege of meeting Dr. Sheyavali in Vancouver just last month at the World Council of Churches meeting, and he told me that in addition to all of this which I have said to you, they face an increasing problem in Namibia with the internal refugees, people who are fleeing the war effort in the north and coming down to the capital city of Windhoek and around the area where the Sumeb mines are and other economic interests, that the women and the children come. They have no place to stay. There is no food. There is no program for them. There is no clothing. There is no medical help. There is no shelter. They simply live in the open, and they eat whatever they can scratch to eat. The women of the church are trying to figure out a way to respond to this, but it is a massive problem as more and more of them flee the war in the north. This is a pretty grim picture, but it's what's going on, and it's what's happening every day to men and women who are our Lutheran brothers and sisters in that part of the country. And I have to ask myself the question, why? For what purpose? What can we do about all this? There are several things. You should know, first of all, what we have done. Yes?
You mentioned that, as a matter of information, you mentioned you would state about Castro troops in there, and what is that situation?
I have to digress from the story of Namibia for a moment.
Oh, okay.
Angola, which is the country immediately north of Namibia, was a Portuguese territory, and it went through its own struggle for independence. And just as in many other African countries, there were two tribal groups two Angolan groups who cooperated during the war for independence. But when independence was won, there was an election and one group came into power and the other group was out of power. This group which has been out of power has started, in effect, a civil war, a guerrilla activity in Angola along the southern and eastern borders to try to destabilize and unseat the government of Angola, which is in power. South Africa is supporting that guerrilla group, the group that's out of power. And there is some evidence that the CIA of the United States has also given support to that guerrilla group. The Angolan government asked Cuba to send troops to help them patrol their borders to resist this guerrilla group. And so there are about 2,000, we understand, Cuban troops in here. There are no Soviet troops in here at all. We understand that some of the South African forces who are working in the southern Angola area, they make raids across into Angola all the time, just with impunity, are Israeli mercenary troops that are financed in large measure by the United States. So that's the reason why the Cuban troops are there. The Angolan government and SWAPO says the Cuban troops have no relationship to the Namibian conflict, that they are related entirely to the civil struggle inside of Angola. And Angola has said furthermore that if and when South Africa stops supporting the guerrilla troops, they will ask the Cuban soldiers to go home because they won't need them anymore. It's just that as long as the guerrillas in Angola who are fighting the government in power are getting support from outside sources, the Angolan government needs help to get from outside sources to maintain itself in power. So that's the reason they're there.
Is it just a jealousy that exists of those two groups in Angola as to who should run the country?
It's a jealousy, it's a traditional conflict, it's an ideological conflict. I mean, we have differences between Republicans and Democrats, right? We don't take guns up over them.
Yeah.
But there are different opinions on how the government and the country ought to be run. I don't know as much about that as I should and would like to, but there is a conflict there. You should know, and you should be very proud, that the Lutheran churches around the world have been steady and steadfast in their support of the Namibian churches and the Namibian church leaders. The primary vehicle for this support has been through the Lutheran World Federation, an international organization of Lutheran churches located in Geneva, Switzerland. They have given material aid to the churches to help them with offices. They have given aid for health supplies, for educational supplies. They have a program such as the one I worked with, which helps train and educate Namibian leaders. When the press was blown up, it was an immediate response by the Lutheran churches around the world, which raised the money necessary to rebuild, replace, and have that press in installation within 6 months after it was blown up. So it came back into operation just a year ago in June. Yes?
You may have pointed that in 8 hours there were people there after the press was blown up in spite of that curfew. Did you finish up what you were saying?
Oh, sorry, yes, I do get distracted. The press was blown up at midnight, and the call went to the South African Defense Forces at midnight, within 20 minutes of the press having been blown up. And they are able to move freely because they have vehicles and lights, and they're the ones who patrol the curfew. But they did not come until 9 o'clock the next morning to investigate the press and to see what had happened.
You know, who was called, who came.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there are so many stories to tell you, but we're running out of time. Let me just say what is happening. The U.S. churches, of course, have been very supportive of the LWF efforts. Much money from the U.S. Lutheran churches has gone to the LWF to help the Namibian work. And also, the U.S. churches have been directly involved in that several times leaders of our churches have made visits to Namibia. And these visits are very important because the visibility that is focused on the situation in Namibia, when people go in and can see what is happening and bring back the stories, then this puts a lie to the South African propaganda that the situation in Namibia is getting better. The most recent visit was in January of this year when Bishops Preuss and Crumley accepted the invitation of Bishop Dumeni to attend the 100th anniversary of the baptism of the first Namibian in the Ovambo Kavango Church. They were able to get visas to go. The LWF personnel and the Finnish personnel who wanted to go to celebrate that event with their brethren and sisteren were forbidden visas by the South African government. As I said before, Dr. Wee was there in June of 1979, and a tape of his visit is in the library. Just this month, in August of 83, last month, the ALC and LCA and AELC and Lutheran World Ministries have reached a decision to begin a major education and advocacy effort on behalf of Namibia. This has several goals. One of them is to educate people in the United States, particularly in the Lutheran Church, about the situation in Namibia, what is going on, and what can be done about it. Another effort is to work specifically in congressional and presidential elections coming up to find out the stance of candidates and to persuade them to support efforts which will bring the Namibian people to the implementation of Resolution 435 and free and fair elections for that country. We want to change U.S. policy. We want to elect those people who will change U.S. policy. And also, this effort will lay the groundwork for future U.S.-Namibian relations, where the United States may perhaps have one final opportunity to take the side of people in their struggle for independence and liberation, where they have so often chosen the other side of that. They also hope this advocacy effort will encourage all of us to consider, both in our churches and in the activities of our government, economic and political sanctions against the Republic of South Africa, which have some teeth in them, so that South Africa pressure will be brought to bear on them to force them to comply with the United Nations resolution.
How does that resolution read again? 435?
It has four parts. It calls, first of all, for an immediate ceasefire, military ceasefire. It calls for free and fair elections to be supervised by the United Nations through a team of observers throughout the country. It calls for the withdrawal of South African troops and for the release of all political prisoners.